From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Most college-bound young people spend several months hovering by the mailbox. They're waiting for not one but two letters. The first, obviously, tells them they got into the school of their choice. Or didn't. The second letter, which has been going out in recent weeks, says whom they'll be rooming with. But as Shannon Mullen reports, some schools are trying a new method, letting kids choose their own roommates online.
This fall, 17-year-old Jamila Connell will be a freshman at Mount Ida College, a small liberal arts school near Boston. She's filling out a roommate selection form that asks how often she does laundry, whether she minds overnight guests.
How do you feel about sharing stuff?
Sharing is caring. I mean, we learned this when we were 5.
Instead of mailing in her answers, Connell has an online profile with her picture, like a Facebook page. And instead of the school choosing a random roommate for her, she can pick one herself.
I just clicked search and I found someone named Ashley. Let's see her profile basics. She's 18, clean. Oh, she likes to study in the library. Nice. Someone I can get along with already.
A growing number of colleges and universities are offering web-based programs that let students pick their own roommates. 24 schools, including Rutgers, Tulane, Sacred Heart, and Mount Ida College, use a service called Roommate Click. Mount Ida's residence life director, Laura DeVoe, says it saves loads of paperwork. She calls it Facebook with a purpose.
I love Facebook. I'm not going to lie. Friend me. That's cool. What this does is it narrows down the functionality of Facebook in terms of the networking for this particular generation. They feel more comfortable because they've connected online.
Sophomores Warren Zimmer and Dan Fissel bonded on Roommate Click over their love of video games when Mount Ida first offered the service last year. Zimmer says it made moving in less awkward.
The first week really set the tone for the rest of the year. That's how it was going to be, and it worked out great.
And the first week, there wasn't too much laundry, so we didn't really know that I'm not as moderately clean as I said.
I also learned that I wasn't as clean as I thought I was.
It was a pretty good match, yeah.
Zimmer and Fissel have heard of a few bad matches, but they say most of their friends have had positive outcomes. With Roommate Click, schools can customize the site's features to try to curb misuse. Rutgers doesn't let students post profile pictures to prevent discrimination based on factors like race or sexual orientation. And Roommate Click's parent company, Lifetopia, monitors students' profiles for offensive material. But VP of Sales Bill Schneider says there's no foolproof way to prevent discrimination.
Everybody knows that they will go to Facebook and they will find their potential roommate, what they look like, and maybe get into more depth than our site would serve them.
At Mount Ida College, Laura DeVoe's concern was that students who self-select might miss out on something formative. When she was in college, she was randomly matched with a girl from Texas.
She put on mascara loud. I've never seen a person in my life who could be so loud. And there were times where I learned through that experience how to speak up for myself.
But DeVoe says kids who pair up online still have to learn how to live together in person. Some students don't want to choose their own roommates. DeVoe matches them the old-fashioned way, but she warns it won't be totally random. She likes to put Red Sox and Yankee fans in the same room. For NPR News, I'm Shannon Mullen.
As an old line industry recovers, a much newer industry considers its future. Google and Verizon came out with a proposal this week for new legislation to regulate the internet.
It was just 2 pages long with a lot of language about ensuring equal access and preserving the internet as we know it. But the reaction was strong.
In fact, here are some headlines. The Google-Verizon proposal is worse than evil.
Google-Verizon pact may herald end of equal access internet.
You can easily find more headlines. Just
Google them.
Planet Money's Alex Bloomberg explains why so many people are so upset.
Most of the outrage over the Google-Verizon proposal comes down to one phrase, the one that says that internet service providers could, under certain circumstances, engage in, and here's the phrase, quote, traffic prioritization. This is code for a debate that's been raging for over a decade now, the debate over net neutrality. To understand this debate, let's log on to the internet, shall we? Hulu.com, this is the site I go to watch television programs on the internet, television programs like ABC's Bachelor Pad.
If I had to choose between walking out of here with the love of my life or $250,000, I take the money and run.
Right now, my local internet service company, Time Warner Cable in New York, doesn't really care what I do on the internet. Whether I'm watching Bachelor Pad on Hulu, or checking baseball scores on ESPN, or scrolling through the hilarious pictures at stuffonmycat.com, to Time Warner Cable, it's all the same. That's because, according to economist Scott Holliday at the Institute for Policy Integrity, the internet is neutral.
In a neutral network, your cable provider has no ability to dictate which websites you go to. But in a non-neutral internet, then your cable provider might choose to slow down traffic from competing websites.
In other words, my service provider could engage in that contentious phrase, traffic prioritization. My service provider could prioritize certain websites over others. Websites that paid for priority service would work fine, but if Hulu didn't want to pay and got relegated to slower, lower priority service, then if I went to watch Bachelor Pad, this is what it could sound like.
If I had to choose between walking out of here with the life or $1 million, I'd take the money and
it's not in the interest of an internet service provider to stifle content.
This is Scott Walston, an economist at the Technology Policy Institute. He says that a lot of the dark predictions about traffic prioritization are overblown. For one thing, he says, it's already illegal for an internet service provider to arbitrarily block content. And for another, it doesn't make any economic sense for them to do it anyway.
Because more content increases demand for their service. And the more demand there is for the service, the more they can charge for it. And the more people will sign up for it. So they don't want to be in the business of picking and choosing who gets to be on their network, because that only devalues their network.
For Scott Walston, if internet service providers can do traffic prioritization, it's good for you and me and everyone who uses the internet. We get the same internet we have now, and then we also get a better, higher quality internet for the sites that are willing to pay for it. For Scott Holliday, though, the other economist named Scott in the story, on the other side of the net neutrality question, he says, no, 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 it wouldn't work that way. If an internet service provider is offering priority, fast lane service, companies would only pay for that service if it's noticeably better. So in Scott Holliday's future, internet service providers would have an incentive to make regular service worse.
That's when all of a sudden the incentive flips and all of a sudden capacity crunches make them money. And that's the disincentive that I personally worry about.
The problem with talking about net neutrality, you have to use words like might and maybe and hypothetical. The truth is, all we have at this point are two opposing visions of what might happen. What we know, though, when it comes to the internet, most of our predictions about its future are wrong. For NPR News, I'm Alex Blumberg.
And while we're on the subject of mobile devices and money, let's pose a question. Should you be paid for using a company BlackBerry while you're off the clock? Police sergeant in Chicago thinks so. He's filed a lawsuit against the city and says that he's due plenty of overtime back pay because he logged in on his BlackBerry to continue working even though his shift was over. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
Go to any office, any coffee shop, ride a train or take a bus, and you see them. Employees, eyes glued to those tiny devices in their hands, getting rid of emails or taking care of some other work.
Well, I have a BlackBerry and I have an iPhone.
Catherine Merritt, who works at Ketchum Public Relations, says her iPhone is personal. The BlackBerry is for work.
It definitely is a little bit of a crackberry.
In her office, she was syncing up her BlackBerry with her computer so she could check in on work later.
I don't know that it would extend to hours upon hours, but I think the frequency, I check it at least a few times, probably an hour.
Often, electronic leashes, mobile devices mean work can go on forever. Zev Solomon, a real estate developer with Belgravia Group, doesn't mind, though. He always carries his BlackBerry, and it has a nickname, too.
We affectionately refer to it as my binky.
Like a security blanket. Drives his wife a little crazy, but when Solomon goes to sleep, the BlackBerry goes to bed with him, too.
The ability to continually watch what's coming in and going on in the various parts of the company just feels critical.
Salomon says there's no financial compensation, but he thinks being so connected is just part of the world we're in. Maybe so, but Chicago Police Sergeant Jeffrey Allen argues his connection means the city of Chicago owes him lots of overtime. His attorney, Paul Geiger, says it's a simple case.
What we are saying is he's using this mobile device at the behest of the police department very routinely and very often off duty and not being compensated for all the time spent on the device doing the city's work.
The city gave Allen a BlackBerry when he worked in a unit determining what assets of criminals police could seize. Susan Prince, an attorney with Business and Legal Report, says the deciding factor in this dispute would likely be the Fair Labor Standards Act, which governs wage and overtime provisions for American workers.
Basically, it comes down to whether an employee is exempt or non-exempt. Exempt employees, they make the same salary no matter how many hours they work during a week, so using a BlackBerry from home at night is not an overtime issue for them. But when you're dealing with non-exempt employees, they have to be paid for all the time they work.
That means hourly workers like Sergeant Allen and some salaried ones, too, like secretaries. Employees who spend an insignificant amount of time, say 2 or 3 minutes of checking email in an evening, don't qualify for overtime. But 10 or 15 minutes a day after work hours, that can add up under the federal law. And it can mean 2 years of overtime back pay from the date a lawsuit is filed. 3 years if the employer knew what was going on. So what does City Hall think about the lawsuit?
Silliness in time of economic crisis.
Chicago Mayor Richard Daley scoffed at the lawsuit during a press conference on a different subject last month.
This is unbelievable. We're public servants. If I asked for that, I'd be paid millions of dollars. We have to take all the BlackBerries away from public servants.
I don't think any mayor would say that anti-discrimination laws are silly. These are similar laws.
Sean Rogers, a former labor relations chief for the IRS and a former D.C. cop, heads an arbitration firm. He says although there have been a few lawsuits like Chicago's filed in the private sector, most settle. Rogers says employers handing out mobile devices don't seem to be focusing on potential costs.
I had one arbitration that involved 7,000 employees, and it ultimately settled for something over $23 million.
One solution? Only give BlackBerries to employees who don't qualify for overtime. But attorney Paul Geiger says that would leave hourly workers like Sergeant Allen out of the loop. What's needed, he says, is a standard policy.
If they say, here, you know, sign for this BlackBerry, here are the BlackBerry rules. Rule number one, you do not use this device off duty. Game over.
Sergeant Allen works in a police district now and doesn't have a department BlackBerry. But his lawsuit is not only for him. It seeks overtime pay for other Chicago police officers who also use their BlackBerries for work while off duty. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
And now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Producer Lee Hill, our digital media guy, joins me here in the studio. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. You delivered a commentary Monday about First Lady Michelle Obama's recent trip to Spain, and it just about set our virtual world on fire. Here's a clip.
Can I just tell you, this trip was a bad idea and will leave a sour taste in the mouths of any number of people who wish the Obamas nothing but the best. What hurts right now is that there are millions of people who cannot put new clothes on their kids' backs, let alone designer duds, or keep a roof over their heads no matter how hard they try, let alone jet off to pricey vacation spots.
And between our combined web audience on Facebook and on NPR.org, thousands of people, Michelle.
Thousands?
Thousands responded to your critique of Mrs. Obama's timing for her trip abroad. Here's a note we received from Jill. She writes, quote, I was so in agreement with what Michelle said about the hurt we as a nation felt when we heard about the extravagance of Mrs. Obama's vacation. The tone of Michelle's commentary was appropriate, and Jill goes on to say it's uplifting to have those feelings validated in a public forum such as the radio. But Michelle, I have to tell you, not everyone agreed with you and Jill. Commenter John posted this to our online forum. He writes, quote, the Obama administration has done more to help underprivileged Americans than any other administration in recent memory. And criticizing Michelle Obama for an innocent little vacation undermines the work she, her husband, and his administration has done to help low-income families. John goes on to write, quote, if Michelle Obama was blowing her nose with $100 bills, then yes, Michelle Martin, I could understand your reproach, but a vacation with her 9-year-old daughter? Not so much.
Okay. Well, thank you, John, and everybody who chimed in with their opinions. Lee, as part of our ongoing look at elder care, this week's parenting conversation focused on a sensitive subject, taking care of parents who didn't take particularly good care of you. Here's a clip from that conversation with one of our guests, a regular contributor, Leslie Morgan Steiner.
My mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer last November, and she came to live with us in February for what turned out to be the last 10 weeks of her life. It was a relatively short period. And my relationship with my mother had always been emotionally complicated. She was there for me during my marriage to an abusive man and my divorce from him, as she had always been physically there. But the problem was emotional, and she was emotionally abusive.
And I want to say that many people wrote to us, and I very much appreciated the sensitivity, the care, the range of views that people expressed. Listener Grace Ann reached out to us from London.
My mother passed away when I was 21, and I miss her every day. My relationship with my father, never easy, deteriorated beyond repair from the time of my mother's death, and he has never, ever lifted a finger to help me through the difficulties of my own failing health, the loss of my home, and my marriage to an abusive husband. I wish him well and feel bad that the promise I made to my mother to take care of Daddy is being broken. For my own health and emotional safety, however, this is the way it will have to be. You can't behave horribly to someone for so long and then turn to them and request their assistance simply because you now have a need. One's behavior does and should have consequences.
Well, I want to thank Grace Ann for having the courage to share that story, as well as all those who wrote in with these very personal stories. Lee, anything else?
Michelle, we have an update to a discussion we had last week about the government's no-fly list, and we talked to Ayman Latif. He's a U.S. citizen and former Marine who moved to Egypt from Miami in 2008, but earlier this year, Latif went to the airport attempting to return to the U.S. to visit family when he was told he was on the no-fly list. And Michelle, this week we received an official government response to that conversation, and we'll post the statement in its entirety on our blog. But here's an excerpt. Quote, "The no-fly list is well-grounded in legal authority. Congress has expressly authorized airlines to prevent an individual who has been identified as a threat to civil aviation or national security from boarding an aircraft," end quote.
And I do want to emphasize that we did invite a representative of the government to participate in our conversation, and they declined. But we do appreciate their perspective as expressed in this statement. And as Lee said, we'll have it on our site. Lee, we've also been reporting on the fight for same-sex marriage, especially in California, where a federal judge last week overturned the state's voter-approved ban on same-sex marriage. But yesterday, the same judge, Vaughn Walker, ruled that gay marriages should remain on hold until at least August 18th. His ruling will give opponents time to appeal his earlier decision to the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals.
And, of course, we'll continue our coverage as that story unfolds.
And we will. Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To read what listeners are saying and to weigh in with your own thoughts, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that's 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. And you can also go to our website, log on to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Many Americans get through a day, even a week, without paper money. These days, people use credit or debit cards to pay for a cup of coffee or a subway fare, not just a major purchase. Money has become mobile, and the next technological advance may even make cards antique. Glenn Doreen, the senior technology editor for Popular Mechanics, joins us from our studios in New York. Mr. Doreen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So I gather that there are some smartphone companies that are trying to change or even abolish the credit card.
Well, actually, it's the credit card companies as well as the phone carriers that are interested in turning phones into credit cards themselves. In other words, essentially taking over the function of the many cards you might have in your wallet.
And the credit card companies might find this appealing because they can get out of the plastics and paper business.
That's true, and it allows them a lot of flexibility. In fact, it's interesting. This is as much a business story as it is a technology story because the technology that they're trying to implement is actually not brand new and is even found in some of the contactless cards that exist right now.
I don't know what a contactless card is.
Well, essentially, there are a lot of credit cards right now that have an embedded chip in them that allow you to just tap and pay.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me get my wallet out. Sorry. So a contact – I have no idea about this. So I'm looking at both a Visa and an American Express card. American Express has printed on the top of my card, "Don't take this card from this man." But in any event, so there's a chip in these things nowadays?
Some of them there is. In fact, a lot of people are carrying around what's called an RFID or radio frequency ID card.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't even know it. A lot of credit cards right now have these things embedded in them. And a lot of corporate cards, for instance, when people just wave a card to get through a door, it's all the same technology. And the idea is that they want to embed that into little chips that would go inside your phone. Mm-hmm. And in many stores across the country. People have been tapping to pay for coffee for a couple of years now.
And there's some area of the world, too, aren't there, in which mobile phones are being used as devices of commerce already? I mean, even transmitting large amounts of money.
That's right. In the developing world, especially, phones tend to be a good way of doing your banking because, essentially, people don't necessarily live near a bank branch, and banks can't make a good business case for rolling out bank branches deep into areas where there aren't a lot of people. And yet, the mobile infrastructure has rolled out to those areas. It's far more widespread than other forms of commerce are. So you end up seeing banking piggybacking on top of the cellular the basic cellular communications.
Mm-hmm. And I gather that this has been an advantage to actually some organizations we've probably done stories about on this show, where, for example, an NGO that's working in a certain country no longer has to worry about physically putting money into a payroll on a truck that might be vandalized. They can just hit a transmit button and everybody who's been working for them gets paid.
Yeah, and this is really just the outgrowth of the way that banking has become pretty virtualized. So once money becomes data, you can transmit the information that essentially carries that money over cellular networks pretty easily. And there are some obvious security concerns for all of this stuff. Hackers can potentially compromise a lot of these systems, but there's also a lot of security benefits as well. And you just mentioned one. Rolling a truck full of money out is probably as likely, if not more likely, to get stolen as sending out a lot of bits that equal money.
Well, explore some of the disadvantages with this too, though, that that people might feel as they hear about this brave new world.
Well, it's interesting. Like I mentioned, there's the security issue. In fact, with RFID credit cards, people have already demonstrated, researchers have already demonstrated that you can hijack these systems. You can, with the right equipment, essentially sort of brush by somebody and get the information off of that card, off of that chip. And then there's just the sort of consumer confusion that can go on with this. The last thing that the credit card companies want to do is make the process of paying for something any more complicated than it has to be.
And of course, then you can't pay for a cup of coffee if you neglected to recharge your cell phone.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, you're right. And also,
or if you leave your cell phone on the subway.
Also a very interesting concern that people could have. I mean, everybody has probably had the experience of losing a cell phone. It feels like your entire life has been lost. And if your wallet is essentially in your cell phone as well, it's sort of a double whammy.
Mm-hmm. I can remember a number of years ago when people said, I will never line up at a wall to get cash.
And now people do it routinely, of course.
Yeah, and I can remember when people said that they would never use a credit card to pay for groceries or at a drugstore because that way their purchases could be monitored, and if they bought Playboy or rutabaga, someone would be able to tell.
Well, actually, it even goes further. The possibilities go further here. When you integrate payment systems with a device that is connected wirelessly, and you also have GPS devices integrated into a lot of these phones now as well, you can push out deals and promotions and advertisements.
Yeah. As you're reaching for the rutabagas, you could get a message saying, and you might want to try the tomatoes too.
Exactly.
And I suppose you could also, if you're reaching for a Boston cream pie, you could get an email from your doctor saying don't.
You could, conceivably, but I doubt the credit card companies are going to want to have that one pushed on to you. They want you to buy the cream pie.
Well, Mr. Doreen, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Glenn Doreen, Senior Technology Editor for Popular Mechanics.
With back-to-school season underway, many retailers are turning to a newfound marketing force, the phenomenon of online haul videos. The videos feature young women sitting before webcams and sharing with the world everything they bought or hauled home from the mall.
Next, I got this little, not jacket, not shirt, not shawl, I don't know, not cardigan because it doesn't button or anything. It's just long.
That's Blair Fowler, one of the more popular haulers. Her YouTube channel has drawn more than 75 million views. That's the kind of captive audience fashion retailers can't ignore. For more, we turn to Beverly Macy. She's a marketing executive who teaches social media marketing at the UCLA Business and Management Extension Program. She's at NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Are retailers involved in this at all?
Absolutely. Forever 21, TJ Maxx, lots of retailers are beginning to really take notice. And what's beginning to happen is we're seeing that some of these bloggers, especially the more popular ones, will say at the beginning of the vlog, so JCPenney's gave me this $1,000 gift certificate and I got 10 outfits.
It seems the companies are maybe taking some risks in letting these young fashionistas have a role in their marketing. I mean, you know, you get a gift certificate or something, but what if their product gets panned and that goes viral?
Well, that's a really good point. So what we like to say is reviews are the new advertising. And so this idea that people just like me will talk about a product that matters to me. And the risk, as you mentioned, is that they're going to like it and they might also not like it. But what the social media sphere is all about is authenticity. So the retailers are willing to take the risk that the reviewers, so to speak, the young girls in this case, will be very honest and their audience will appreciate the honesty.
Are more companies embracing social media as an established business practice instead of, say, just a fleeting trend?
You know, that is the question of the day. And the answer is yes, they are. So brands are trying to obviously find the return on investment. In the case of the teen haulers, if you've got an audience of 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 people that are going to watch what you have to say, and they're people who are going to potentially buy the product, again, that is a return on investment. And think about it. The brand is not spending very much money to do this. So it's a pretty good deal for everybody.
Beverly Macy. Her forthcoming book is titled The Power of Real-Time Social Media Marketing. She joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Thank you.
Thank you.